Attention. Your paradigm is about to shift at the intersection of fact and reason. You're entering Kingston Country.
I'm Dan Kingston, and you're listening to the Dan Kingston Podcast.
All right, today, Benjamin Manis, former law enforcement officer, currently public safety and security expert at Manis & Associates. Ben, welcome to Kingston Country.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You know, you wrote about a COVID-19 pandemic being used as an excuse for the rising violent crime, an explosion in crime across this country. I'd love to talk about that, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely. I wrote about that in Broad and Liberty, which is a local think tank publication here in the Philadelphia area. God, this is 8 months ago now, but you know, ironically, major police agencies coast to coast are still relying on this COVID excuse for really what should be, you know, a shift in policy. Not ironically, but coincidentally, these are the same very cities that are employing very radical policies that are going hands off and restricting law enforcement, killing law enforcement morale. And at the same time, have district attorneys, many of them who were not prosecutors. They were elected based on very radical political views and outside money. So, you know, you have people who really are derelicting their oath of office, blaming COVID for what should be a very clear trajectory of upward crime that has nothing to do with the pandemic.
So basically, their incompetence is they're covering it up and blaming it on COVID when really it's the policies. And what exactly, I mean, you kind of talk about it a little bit. Is it like the second guessing of police that's leading to this? I mean, if you're going to police, then why should they enforce at the same level? Is that one of the problems, or what specifically are the policies that the Democrats being in control and just having catering to crime?
Yeah, so there's a variety depending on what city you're looking at. I wouldn't go as far as just blaming it on incompetence. Obviously, incompetence was the underlying issue in many of these jurisdictions. And for example, I did a decade on the job in Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. is traditionally one of the most corrupt and incompetent jurisdictions in the United States. Now, we're talking about Washington City. So, you know, the problem with being a podcaster, Dan, is, you know, when people talk about Washington, they're talking about Capitol Hill and national news. No, there's a city there, and that city is every year in the top 10 in American crime. And, you know, it's a shame because it is the only city in America where the mayor, you know, there's no governor. So the mayor gets to go right to federal, you know, powers, the legislative branch for their funding. And they receive perks that almost no mayor in America gets because of their position as the nation's capital. But they have been so mismanaged over the years that, you know, it has always been a train wreck there since its inception. And mind you, I say the inception is 1974, not the birth of D.C., but the inception of it as an independent city because it was a federal district before that. So when you think about this, I want you to understand that, you know, places like Camden, Philly, D.C., Detroit, St. Louis, you know, they were always somewhat mismanaged and definitely had their own corruption problems. And when you add in the last 5 to 6 years of radical politics that have basically injected it bifurcated the old democratic machines in these cities and injected, you know, very progressive district attorneys because they were low-hanging fruit elections, easily bought.
This is years and years in the making. And what happened with COVID-19, you write it's an amplifier. And I think that's 100%.
Yes.
It's an amplifier. And how so? How did it become an amplifier, Ben?
So let's use two cities as an example. Let's use New York and let's use Philadelphia.
Okay.
So Philadelphia was the first major city where George Soros was able to get a prosecutor elected based on criteria that had nothing to do with their ability to be a prosecutor. He had done it in smaller cities like Orlando with Aramis Ayala, But, you know, this is a city of 1.5 million, and it is currently the most dangerous big city in America. Big city meaning over a million. It has always been, not always, but for the last half a century, been the poorest big city over a million people in America. So when you took those traditional issues and then added a DA that basically had a decarceration agenda and demoralized the police department. So he was not prosecuting a majority of the cases that were coming to his office.
And then what's the point of police officers to bring anything to go out there and enforce the law exactly. when it's not even being prosecuted?
Yeah, so you're adding that to this now. In New York, similar occurrence where, you know, 8 years of de Blasio and, you know, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party taking an extreme hold in regards to fundraising and political clout, electing a state assembly that passed a bill that basically made bail illegal. So you couldn't take bail on a majority of crimes, meaning most people were released on recognizance, even for violent crimes in the city of New York. So you had these two issues in Philly, New York, and there are other cities I could cite, but these are great prime examples. And, you know, you had those. Then
if I could just go back to the bail thing, you know, so you couldn't post bail, and because of that, people were just released.
Yeah. So the argument, and you know, there have been other really egregiously unconstitutional laws that have been passed since, but the argument on the bail law in New York was that cash bail, was a poverty tax on citizens that, had they been more affluent, would have been able to be out on recognizance pending trial. But they're being held behind bars because they can't afford to post bail, completely ignoring the fact that they're in jail pending a trial for a reason.
Right.
And the idea of bail isn't to grab money, but to post surety, i.e. you get your bail back if you go to court. Right.
Right. Right.
But the majority exactly. of these folks, you know, whether they had the cash in their pocket or not, weren't showing up at court.
And the bigger the crime, the bigger the bail you have to post. It's not dependent on the amount of money the person has. It's related to the crime, right?
Right. I mean, we're seeing the stupidity around these types of laws just metastasize like a cancer all over the country. To bring up Philly again, just last week, they passed something called the Driving Equity Act, where the Philadelphia police, under city code, now it's a city ordinance, i.e. just a municipal one, right? So they could only make municipal authorities do it. But the fourth largest police department in the country is now being told not to enforce the vehicle code. So you could be driving, you know, a car with, you know, a bumper hanging down and, you know, a taillight out and a tint that's, you know, dark as midnight and music blaring out the windows. And those can't be used to what they used to call as a requisite stop. So if I stop you for that stuff and I walk up to the window and it's, you know, strongly billowing the odor of marijuana, I'm going to step you out and search that car.
Yeah, well, I don't want to pick on marijuana here, Ben, but
you're a California guy, right?
Talking with you. This is it's a real problem, you know, because the percent of crime, you put out the figure, 74% rise in murder in Seattle, 55% increase in Chicago. Portland has a 51% increase. Boston, 54.
Those stats are 8 months old. It's gotten worse.
It's gotten worse, and I believe it, because when you're outside, you're driving down the road, I'm in California, I don't see police anymore. For 2 years, I rarely see a police.
Now, where are you in California? In L.A.?
San Jose area.
Oof, even worse. Yeah, I mean, you know, you're gonna, like I said, the Larry Krasner's and Aramis Ayala's and Kim Gardner's of the country were prototypes for guys like George Gascon in L.A. and Chesa Boudin in San Francisco. So why would you, a cop, go out and risk their career, namesake, livelihood, get indicted? And I've had some experience with this, for basically doing your job and doing things within the Constitution, knowing that you have the target on your back and the criminal doesn't.
I got to ask you this question, Ben, as a former law enforcement officer, you know, and you brought up the marijuana thing, right? Yep. And I think there's a fine line. How do we get the tough criminals off the streets and allow maybe some of these minor infractions to go? I mean, we don't want to have a police state, obviously. No. We don't want to be like China, okay? But at the same time, you have murders going through the roof. So how do you balance that?
With some good old-fashioned old-school policing. Look, I honestly don't care if you smoke weed or not, and it's legal in your state. But there's a couple of things to realize. Anytime you make something legal, it has to be regulated. Hmm. And the problem with marijuana isn't that people smoke. I mean, let me put this in perspective. I was a D.C. cop in Southeast in Anacostia, which is the worst neighborhood in D.C., right?
Okay.
I have never in my career made a possession of marijuana arrest. So the argument that people are being mass incarcerated for holding weed is not true. Big city,
it's not happening.
Departments, even in like L.A., aren't running in a dime bag of weed because their desk sergeant would laugh them out of the station house. You don't waste a half a shift doing paperwork on weed. But here's the big but. All the blood tests, pee tests, or hair tests for, you know, drugs do is test for the substance of, right? So when it comes to marijuana, you could be driving, and if you plow into a family, you know, crossing the street and are rendered unconscious at the scene, they pull blood. All it says is, hey, I had marijuana in my system for the last 3 weeks, right? So that's the problem is, you know, taking it back to that hypothetical with the tinted glass. If I step up to your car and it's obvious you've been smoking weed in a moving car, you're driving under the influence. This isn't, you know, it's the same as if you had that 40 ounce of Old English in your lap. That's also illegal.
Well, yeah, well, you know, when you're stoned, people drive slower. Mm-hmm. And I've seen facts and figures going both ways, that it's equal with alcohol and also that it's not. So I think it's up for debate, but I hear what you're saying, Ben. I want to circle back around.
You don't pull the tools of, you know, the few people left in the street that are trying to put a finger in the jam and then, you know,
100%
tools away from them.
100%. You got to back up the people that are enforcing the law, and you got to give them the right tools. And what they're up against every day is just unimaginable unless you've done it yourself.
Right.
And so I can't put myself in your shoes, having done that and keeping it safe and this kind of thing. And I know people, you know, obviously, you're not locking people up for pot, but if somebody's smoking pot and then you find a gun in their car like that, there's that too, right?
Yeah, it's why they call it a requisite stop, because, you know, it's when you step them out for the vehicle code violation, or you step them out for the driving under the influence, or, you know, they're acting suspiciously, or their license isn't right. There's a million things that you get off of traffic stops and domestics are the two most common things that police encounter in America. Mm.
Like domestic violence, like a couple's fighting.
Yeah, that's what calls them. And look, let me generalize this issue and let this be the tagline for your podcast. Every time someone tries to wrongfully label law enforcement as a profession as systemically racist because they throw stats about the number of people incarcerated at you, right, or the types of people incarcerated at you, they're forgetting the main issue, which, you know, maybe you have to have a criminal justice degree to understand, or a criminology degree to understand. But look, it's a chicken and an egg argument. I would not be in that community had I not been called into that community.
Right.
And yeah. And this is not Selma, Alabama in the 60s. The fact of the matter is, it takes, you know, 6 months to a year in normal cadence to become a police officer in America, because you have backgrounds, you have academies, you have training, you have vetting, you have numerous tests to pass on the way to that career. Are you trying to tell me someone takes the test for the Chicago, Detroit, Philly police departments and they don't know they're going to be working with African-Americans, Latinos, Asians in a diverse community.
It's, oh yeah,
it's new. These
and they're trying to make it a race community. It's they're trying to make it a race issue when I mean the figures are a huge amount of the law enforcement officers are African American and Hispanic yeah. and yeah. other minorities. It's not a race issue. It's a issue on how do you get rid of the violent crime without curtailing on liberties of the citizens. And I want to talk about the lockdown of 2020.
Yeah, we were actually heading there, but we got sidetracked, so I'm sorry.
Yeah, and this is good. That's what I like about the show is being free and having a conversation about it. The lockdown of 2020 caused a number of things. I mean, in addition to, you write about that contributing to the explosion of crime. Yeah. I want to talk about that, but also like the explosion of overdoses.
I'm in Philly, so that was always a major problem here.
It's more people die of overdoses than car crashes. It's horrible. So let's talk about the lockdown. It had unintended consequences. They told us that it would keep us safe. What really happened?
So, you know, heading into this conversation, we talked a lot about the very reckless policies that were being forwarded in the name of identity politics, in the name of populism, heading into the pandemic. And then lockdowns occurred. Some jurisdictions were prepared for lockdowns, some weren't. The ones that weren't, basically you took a city like New York that had now a law where anyone could commit a crime short of murder and get kicked back onto the streets, and a court system that was closed so they wouldn't even see their trial. Or prelim hearings. And that was your main problem, especially here in Philadelphia. There is a backlog of 2 years worth of gun cases. Wow. So, you know, folks, because they're crying that they could be exposed with COVID in the jail system, are being released on the street and they're not seeing their day in court and they're getting habeas claims. So
2 years? Two years and they're on the streets for waiting? I mean, that's real?
Well, we know the pandemic started in the beginning of 2020, and we know there are still people, some of them that, you know, have a Rittenhouse type claim. They could very well be innocent. They're still pending, you know, the not even the trial, like the very beginning hearings leading to a trial. They haven't even had a jury selection yet.
I want to get into Rittenhouse, by the way, but
we'll get into that in a second. Let me explain this. Even the judges who are elected in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania weren't coming to work. People weren't.
They're going over Zoom or they're not showing up and that's a backlog.
See, that's the point. They didn't start Zooming until really this year, until 2021. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Florida, for example, they have been doing video hearings for inmates at the county jails for years. That was just considered a convenience. You know, they had a room at the jail. You didn't have to have sheriff's deputies transport someone for every time they had a hearing, right? So some jurisdictions really just had to implement some distancing strategies, but had it together. And some completely lost touch. And the ones that completely lost touch are the ones that, if you're looking at the trajectory of crime, are the ones where the crime exploded.
Well, I mean, what about domestic violence during the lockdown? I mean, what about the overdoses and you're a public safety expert. People are suicides through the roof during the lockdown. Yeah. It was a draconian lockdown, a horrible lockdown. You put in your article draconian. A lot of people say it was. It wasn't like China. But honestly, in California, it was more similar than dissimilar. And that was my experience.
I agree.
And this has had a huge effect on the psychology of the country. People have PTSD from it. Am I being dramatic right now?
I don't know about the PTSD. I'm sure. I mean, look, you're looking at it from the perspective of someone, you know, in San Jose. I'm looking at the perspective of someone in, you know, a city. I'm from New York. I worked in D.C. I live in Philly. I did live in L.A. and I used to frequent, you know, other cities like Seattle. So there's a very different perspective on it, depending on what your frame of reference is.
But your grocery stores were empty, right? I mean, the shelves were empty, weren't they?
No, they are now.
They are now.
ironically. No, the only thing that was really hard to find during the pandemic was toilet paper, which is silly because that wasn't a symptom associated with COVID. People just freaked out and went out and bought it all. Yeah. Cleaning supplies, wipes, that kind of stuff was there was a run on it. But I mean, my produce, my meat, everything was easily obtainable until now. Like that, I actually, have 26,000 interactions on a tweet I had basically comparing that. You know, if this, the White House said that the current inflation and the supply chain crisis is due to COVID. Well, if that's the case, why was, everything except those cleaning goods and personal hygiene products available and easily shippable through Amazon during the lockdown period of this crisis, but not available now?
Everything's COVID, Ben. Everything is blamed on COVID, and it could be that way in the foreseeable future. I don't see it changing. Everything is so you really hit upon it in your article.
Again, it changes based on your perception. If you're a Floridian, and I was just in Miami a couple months ago, you've been open over a year. If you're a Texan, where most Californians are now moving, unfortunately, you've been open over a year.
Austin is fantastic. Texas is a fantastic place. I went to Austin.
Texas is fantastic. Austin's becoming, a hybrid of the Bay Area and LA. And
it's fun. I was in Austin. I was seeing young people running around and having fun. And, obviously the politics are different there, but it has a young energy. They're like the workout center of the country, the fitness, everybody's jogging. True. If people were as healthy as they were in Austin, do you think that COVID would even be a thing in this country?
I hate to say this, but if you are on top of your health, I've had COVID twice at this point.
You have?
Yeah. My wife, we're essential workers, so we both had the thing.
Did it hit you hard?
Yeah, no. I've had flus that felt the same. I mean, was it not great having it? I wouldn't recommend it to anyone. But I also don't think we need to run around scared.
Why not get it, though, if you get vaccinated and then you get it? Don't you have more protection? I mean, I heard Joe Rogan talk about this. Let's say you're vaccinated, maybe you should get it. Then you'd have the natural immunity. But I hear what you're saying. You don't want
it. I went the other way with it. I got it and then got vaccinated.
Okay. Do you lose your smell and taste?
Yeah, that was the worst part of it.
Do you get it back?
Yeah, but it took like over a month. Ugh. So that was, it was a very strange part of it. That was the only thing that I couldn't associate with other symptoms. I mean, really, other than that, I was just very tired. But the point I'm making, and maybe I'm just being a tough guy about it. Once you've seen the inside of that animal, I'm not saying if you're a 66-year-old diabetic with obesity, yeah, you should be, worried about it and you should take your health precautions. But to force masks on everyone the way we're doing here in Philly, in a city where smoking and eating greased beef sandwiches is still, the number one pastime.
Yeah.
Come on, we have to be real about this.
Well, you're making marijuana legal and there's obviously, consequences to marijuana, but adults are able to make decisions for themselves. And I tend to be sympathetic to libertarian ideas. And it seems to me we should follow the science with this. It seems COVID seems to be something that affects obese and very old people the most in terms of like death and hospitalization.
100%. Follow the science. And I'm not talking anything Fauci says is the science. I'm saying follow the science. when they're reporting deaths less than they're reporting case, that tells you a lot. But people, I'm in the media now. You need to learn how to watch the media.
Right.
And that's the thing. When we were reporting death numbers every day and there was a COVID briefing at 4 o'clock every afternoon, it was a thing like we had to think about. Now they just report case numbers, which should tell you everything you need to know.
It's all a spin. It's all the spin to keep COVID in the spotlight. And so now I know we're going a little bit over, but if it's okay, I'd love to keep you a bit longer. Yeah. I want to talk about Rittenhouse. What do you make of the Rittenhouse thing? I mean, it's a clown show, right?
Yeah. Well, so as a New Yorker, I grew up in East Village when it was still punk rock. And when I was a kid, we had this shooting on the subway with a neighbor of mine. He was about two blocks up, named Bernard Goetz. And Bernie was the original subway vigilante. It was the early 80s. Two guys tried to rob him with screwdrivers on the train, and he shot him with an illegal revolver. They took him to trial. It was a very highly publicized trial, and the only thing they had to stick him with at the end of the day was the gun. So walking into the Rittenhouse case, I figured the only thing they were going to do was Bernie gets this kid. They were going to stick him for having a, you know, a 17-year-old with a gun.
They dismissed that, right?
Yeah, well, it turns out, and kudos to his lawyers, there is a loophole in Wisconsin law. Why? Wisconsin is the Midwest, and there's a lot of hunting. And this kid had a standard barrel rifle. And, you know, you could give your kid a rifle as long as he's not a criminal or a mental patient. You could basically loan it to him to use in Wisconsin. And as long as he's not being reckless with it or drunk or whatever, there's no crime there.
And that it is very hard for people to believe listening in Berkeley. If I have some people that are, I grew up in Berkeley and California people listening, they can't understand what you're saying right now, how that's possible.
And it's the same with New Yorkers. The idea in for New Jersey, forget it. But the idea basically is, you know, people get obsessed with the tool. And I think that has a lot to do with this prosecution.
Yeah.
Had this not been an AR-15, you know, had this not been during what the media was characterizing as, quote unquote, a peaceful protest, which it wasn't.
What did you make of the Binger pointing the AR-15 at the jury members with his finger on the trigger as a former member of law enforcement, Ben?
I think he's an idiot. Almost everything that guy did to put some dramatic effect on a case that was very shaky from the start, you know, really backfired. And that's the point. He should not have been relying on drama. He should have been relying on law. And he didn't have law in this case. And honestly, he should not have brought the indictment. I mean, we're seeing this over and over again. We have this here with a police prosecution, about three police prosecutions at this point, where all three of these individuals are not in any way guilty of violating the law, but they're being prosecuted because, hey, they're cops, and this guy's campaign promise was, you know, holding the cops accountable. But we're seeing that. We're seeing, you know, the issue with, look, you know, Ben Shapiro says this quite often, which is, you know, he's a Harvard-educated lawyer. The George Floyd case, was an egregious example of failing to render medical aid in a timely manner, which at the most is manslaughter. How they get a murder one is this mass media portrayal of racism. But I have to note, the same way with Kyle Rittenhouse, these weren't hate crime charges. Unless they file some kind of hate crime charge, there is no racial implication on this. It was never brought up in any courts. So you can't tie in the gun is scary looking. You know, a rifle is a rifle is a rifle. Or this kid's a racist if you haven't proven such in a court of law.
Well, it's not just that Rittenhouse is made out to be a racist or domestic terrorist or all the lines that they throw at him, but anybody who asks questions about the case that doesn't immediately buy into that narrative, now you're a racist. Now you're a white supremacist because and that's really the most shocking thing to me about where we are right now is you can't even talk about this case outside of maybe a podcast like this one with anybody. I mean, you talk to it with your family or your friends or a coworker and oh boy, I mean, you could really get in trouble. You could become a political prisoner. You could get investigated by the FBI for talking about this, right?
The really hard part is being a guy like me who's actually board certified in this. So my thing is duty of care and security, right?
What do you mean board certified?
Well, I'm a certified protection professional, a CPP, which is a board certified security manager, a guy who creates security plans for not just, you know, companies and buildings, but, you know, communities, right? Multinationals. Right. You know, you have an issue here, and it's not just here, but it's pretty much every city that burned during 2020. Where the municipality in question failed to uphold their duty of care to protect the public. I wrote a piece several years ago called Letting Them Vent has never worked. And it started with my experiences as a kid in the LA riots. I was there living with my mom in 92. So I experienced that firsthand, what it was like to be in a city that was burning around me. And, the problem is this: every time a department gets a political order from a mayor that said, stand down, let them vent. And the city, goes from protesting to rioting, and they don't put the riot down, it turns into a deadly, costly situation. People lose businesses, they lose lives, they get injured. And that's what happened in Kenosha. But it's not just what happened in Kenosha. It happened in Baltimore with Freddie Gray.
Is it going to happen again, Ben, after the verdict happens? Whatever happens, is there going to be another rioting in Kenosha? Is this just an endless cycle of violence?
I mean, they're protesting in Kenosha, but at the end of the day, it's a white guy who shot two white guys. And I'm a Jewish guy, so I should actually, feel for this in some way. I don't. Because, you play stupid games, you win stupid prizes. These guys were out rioting, and, they caught a lesson they'll never, learn from right now. But the problem is these lessons keep being repeated because nobody is enforcing the law. Let me give you a real example. You want one that's very clear. In Charlottesville, remember, so every time the left side of the aisle wants to make an equivalency argument on the right side of the aisle, they bring up Charlottesville, the Tiki Torch guys, and they bring up January 6th. So let's dissect those a little bit.
Okay.
You had protest and counter protests. The Charlottesville police saw people showing up at the protest with weapons, with improvised weapons, shields, bats, gas masks. People don't show up to a rally with that kind of gear and you're expecting this thing to go well. So that if they'd have made preemptive arrests and gotten that stuff off the street and directed people apart from each other, or at least separated the two factions. And believe me, I know what I'm talking about because in DC, I was on the civil disturbance unit. Mm. And we dealt with a protest every day because it's DC and everyone, it's where the government is, right? So they did not do that basic task to uphold the duty of care for all the people who were there legitimately. And it turned into a riot. People died. Okay. January 6th, same thing. When you have those kind of numbers showing up and you're doing a risk assessment because they're showing up on a day where a vote could go south, they weren't just rallying. It wasn't like, let me compare it to the Million Man March. We had, several hundred thousand people on the mall for the Million Man March, but they were there for a gathering that wasn't based on an event, a current event that could go sideways for what they were rallying for. They were there, to duplicate the March on Washington. So we gave crowd control, but we didn't expect it to go a certain way. January 6th, we knew they were there to protest a vote that was being held that day. We saw numbers responding. The Capitol Police historically asks for close support from the Metropolitan Police Civil Disturbance Unit, which is a lot bigger, and the U.S. Park Police, which is like the state troopers in D.C. because everything's a federal parkway, right? They did not do that. I have
part. Why not?
That's the question. That's the golden question that has still not been asked in any of these fugazi hearings we're seeing on C-SPAN. And I'm telling you, I have my brothers who are still on that job that I worked with 20 years ago who, say they didn't get the call to deploy their district civil disturbance entity.
Well, why should that get clamped down? I mean, why should, in all fairness, you got all these other riots that are allowed to happen all over the place with the Black Lives Matter and Antifa. And the one time that the Patriots are, get out of hand and you crack down on them. And so maybe they were, nobody thought it was going to get to how it got. I think that what you're saying is that you got to nip these things in the butt before they get out of hand, because you crack down a little bit in the beginning on the people that are out of control, so that you don't have to have a massive out of control situation where then you have to bring in like National Guard and it's out of control rioting across like in LA that you experience.
I'm saying every riot for the most part is preventable. Every modern riot. We're not talking about like Newark in the 60s. which flared up off it, or watts that flared.
But do
up.
You think that the thing, you know, you're just letting the cities burn for no. Antifa and Black Lives Matter, that went into the calculation for the Capitol riots whoever's looking at that saying, you know what, maybe we should let them blow off steam just like we let Antifa and BLM blow off steam every time.
I'm saying no one does. I'm saying you're not looking. You have to look at this like a lawman. Both sides of the equation, which is why it's false equivalency, to say that the January 6th idiots was a, you know, and they were idiots.
The ones that were breaking the law, but not everybody.
Yeah, no, I'm just about the ones that tried to literally infiltrate the House floor and didn't think they'd be shot. I mean, and listen, Ashley Babbitt, say what you will about her. She was a veteran, but as a veteran, you know what happens if you charge the gate at a base and don't stop and show your card, right? And it's the same type of thing. You're in a federal facility disobeying the orders of a uniformed police officer. What do you think is going to happen?
Right.
This is. I mean, let's just be honest. This is saying, look, I'm a Jewish guy, right? I have no heart for the guys in the West Bank or Gaza Strip who get shot throwing, you know, incendiary devices at Israeli tanks. You are throwing something at a tank. Did you think this would end well for you?
Oh, God. Yeah.
So this is what I'm talking about. It is a certain, maybe I'm just too street smart growing up in the city, but there's a certain.
No, I love your input. I love your perspective on this because you're very fair and you're looking at it, like you say, from a lawman perspective. And I feel like
this Travis Scott thing from Security Magazine. And it was the same thing. Like,
oh, yeah, the Travis Scott. I could go on about the demonic worship and the portal to hell. This concert looked like a portal to hell.
Yeah, but I could care less about the act on stage. What I'm saying is if I go to Jazz Fest and they have people in various corners of Armstrong Park, or if I'm going to the Stones concert at the Link like I did before COVID, you have to show a ticket and you're brought into a certain section and that section's cordoned off with gates separate from the other sections. Some planning went into that, yeah. Right? Yeah. This is why if you go to like Major League Baseball or the NFL, the union has a security guy, the league has a security guy, the team has a security guy, the stadium has a security guy, the vendors have a security guy, and they all watch each other.
But that's why it looks like the Travis Scott concert was almost set up and planned for catastrophe.
No,
because they are supposed to plan how the crowd would disperse in a crowd surge. And the way that the thing was set up, I mean, as a public safety expert, it's just crazy that happened the way that everything was set up.
It isn't. If you've done this stuff before, the event special event people are historically the cheapest, lowest bidder. Most unprofessional. Look, there's in America, there's security and the appearance of security, which goes back to this whole riot issue, right? If you have a bunch of cops standing around a perimeter, but they're letting people vent and they're actually breaking the law and these cops aren't pouncing on that and stopping it, then it's going to get worse.
And it encourages it almost because like they're letting it happen and the rioters see that. They're emboldened by it.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at how you're funneled into airports like Heathrow or, you know, Ben Gurion, and you compare that to how TSA acts here, you could see one is the appearance of security versus one is real security.
Right.
And that's the problem with this Travis Scott is they did the bare minimum. They gave a bunch of yellow T-shirts to people who had no training, and they didn't, you know, coordinate the event or plan the event properly. And they're going to pay. There's already a $750 million lawsuit on the table. Just that's the first one.
Yeah, so, I hear there's hundreds of lawsuits. Yeah, there's gonna be crazy.
Yeah, there's, I mean, look, I wrote a piece, about the Vegas shooting, and MGM did probably the most egregious attempt to shift liability I've ever seen. They actually filed a suit against the victims.
The Travis Scott thing, they said there was a maniac ejecting people because, of course, that would take liability away from the whole planning.
Yeah. And none of that's true. I mean, none of that.
Right. It's been proven that it's been proven that that was not accurate.
I mean, I wrote a piece about the Alec Baldwin thing. The grossly incompetent, unqualified armorer on that set is now saying that a Trump supporter planted a live round that magically fit that single action Army Colt, to somehow set her up. on an unknown set in the middle of Santa Fe County, New Mexico.
Holy big earthquake here. Big earthquake. Oh, man. Yeah, we just had an earthquake in California. And I'm going to have to end the podcast on that and prepare for an aftershake. But Benjamin Manis, I'd love to have you back on the podcast. You were terrific. And I'll post links to where people can view your writing. Benjamin Manis, former law enforcement officer, currently public safety and security expert at Manis & Associates, and so much more. Thank you for being on the podcast today, Ben.
Kingston Country. You've been listening to the Dan Kingston Podcast.